My name is Tim Lawrence. I'm a Jacksonville native. Since I was a child, I've been interested in making monsters. My favorite movies were Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and King Kong and Frankenstein and Wolfman. I always wanted to know how to do that, and back in the early 60s, there weren't a whole lot of venues for finding that out. There was no internet, there were no DVDs, there was no VHS player. It was hit and miss. It was talk to people who did it in person, and that's what we did. And then I got into audio animatronics and worked with a local company called Sally Industries. And shortly after that, I moved to the West Coast. I had an opportunity to work in animatronics in Southern California, so I moved out there. I had met a fellow named Rick Baker, a six-time Academy Award winner, Rick Baker, when I was a teenager back in 1976, and we stayed in touch. And when he got back to California from working on Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan in London, he called and asked if I would come work with him on a rock video for Michael Jackson on his Thriller album. So I said yes, and I worked in Hollywood makeup effects from that point on for the next 9 or 10 years, working mostly with the Rick Baker Studio on things like Gremlins and Harry and the Hendersons and Starman.
That was Tim Lawrence in the video discussing his illustrious career. He was a man of many talents and great aspirations, including a unique project he began working on for the Jacksonville Zoo called Conservation Arts.
Have you ever wondered what a trip to the zoo is like for a blind person? Conservation Arts is my program for improving their experience.
We work with living animals to make bronze models for public encounters. Things you can put your hands on, ways to get closer to the animals, ways to touch the animals. We mount the bronze models outside animal exhibits where they may be handled as part of the zoo experience. We can create a wall of paws.
Sadly, Tim passed away in 2019, leaving behind his great legacy of work for us to remember him by. However, not all his stories were told. During his career, he was one of the first people employed for Steven Spielberg's film adaptation of the Michael Crichton novel, Jurassic Park. At this time, he helped create the very first incarnation of Jurassic Park's Tyrannosaurus Rex. Despite this milestone, after the film went on hiatus during Spielberg's production of Hook, Tim was replaced by Stan Winston for unknown reasons. But the story of Tim Lawrence's time on Jurassic Park is still one that should be remembered. It's an important piece of the film's history, one that has never been told in any book or program. Years before his death, Tim listed several auctions of his Jurassic Park items on eBay. He provided several pictures and context for all of them. Using these sources and a few others, I have compiled them into a story that are all his words, with short connected phrases to string them together. Voice actor Jay Malone respectively recorded them, which is what you're about to hear now. While the following isn't Tim's voice, they are his stories. May he live on in memory.
My name is Tim Lawrence. Back in 1988-1989, when I was at ILM supervising the creature shop for Ghostbusters 2, they were already doing some tests for Steven Spielberg for Jurassic Park. Steven and I had worked together before, as he was the executive producer on Harry and the Hendersons and Gremlins 2. I remember seeing an early CGI test of a walk cycle for a T-Rex skeleton. At this time, I was asked to develop a budget and schedule for production of full-scale and miniature dinosaurs because originally ILM proposed to contribute all the practical as well as all the visual dinosaur effects. Then, one day, early June 1990, the phone rang. "Hello?" I said. "Tim Lawrence?" the voice said. Yes. Steven Spielberg for you. Okay, I said, and then he came on. Tim? Steven, he said. Dennis, Muren, tells me you're the man to help me with my dinosaur. Sure. Yes? Great. I'm going to turn you over to a production designer, Rick Hart. Looking forward to working with you. I remember also saying, you know, I'm not a dinosaur sculptor. And he said, I don't want a dinosaur sculptor. I want a character sculptor to sculpt a dinosaur. Then Rick Carter came on and asked if I had some clay and tools with me and if I could come down right now. So I put a kit together and went over to the Amblin Story Bungalow on the Universal lot and began the sculptural development of the T-Rex. I sat at the conference table next to Steven. Also in the room were Kathleen Kennedy, Frank Marshall, Rick Carter, Bob Gurr, Mark Hallett, and others. At this early stage, Steven had some ideas. Since in the story, the dinosaur genome was completed with elements of frog DNA, he wondered if the dinosaurs should have some frog features, such as facial ridging, like you see in frogs' faces. At this first meeting, I roughed in two busts that exchanged hands between Steven and I for about an hour. He was really into it. Mark Hallett had some neck wrinkle input, and Rick Carter was focused on the eyes. Kathleen Kennedy was also interested in the eyes. So this was the first day and a lot of ideas in one place. That's how most visual development starts before directions emerge. Next day, Steven was done with the frog idea, and I put these pieces on a shelf, started on the next model. Simple pieces, cartoons. Always the result of a lot of broad input, everyone's ideas included and recorded. Good first session. Everyone was excited and happy because the T-Rex had been moved to the next stage, the next dimension. It's a real special feeling to be in the middle of a creative vortex where a room full of artists are offering ideas that you're real-time sculpting into a model. You see their faces as they witness their ideas taking shape is satisfying. Afterwards, for about the next 8 weeks, my company, Snark Safari Studios, produced a number of development pieces. The very first development bust was of the T-Rex for Jurassic Park. This was an important, historic piece. I made one for Steven, but I still have the mold, and who knows what happened to the other copy when everything went over to Stan Winston's and boxes. This might be the only one. The sculpture was approved and broken into 6 parts for molds. Tom Flouts made the molds and casts quick and dirty overnight so we could get the first mold together ASAP. Tom Hester had been a great friend since Thriller, and an amazing sculptor and anatomist. I assigned a portrait bust sculpt of the T-Rex to him, and these are the only pics of that piece of visual development. These pics were taken at his North Hollywood studio with Polaroid Onyx large format exposures. Not the sharpest photography in the world, but the real thing. Here are a group of behind-the-scenes photographs of my sculptures and reference for the T-Rex expression range maquettes. Curious and furious. These are some of the boards consulted for the work. The T-Rex has a lot of personality in all the drawings. Note scenes that were not filmed. Sneaking around a sleeping T-Rex, T-Rex attacking, raft in river, etc. A black and white photocopy of a T-Rex head sculpt is of Tom Hester's take on Mark Hallett's designs. The T-Rex drawings are all studio copies of Mark's designs used for the work. Some made previous to the Jurassic Park work, and some contemporaneous. Note dates. Also, note handwritten pencil notes showing dimensions. These are Mark's notes. Also, two Mark Hallett original ink and marker studies of the T-Rex head, showing anatomical notes for the jaw movement and fatty deposit movement. 3 Henry Mayo original pencil sketches of possible puppet contours. In addition to a full-sized animatronic T-Rex, there was discussion of lighter constructions to be shot at night in silhouette. These characters would be made of rattan and bamboo, covered with silks and counterbalanced with a pole arm, either at top mount or an off-camera side mount. Not pursued beyond initial discussion. Here's a page-by-page analysis of what is seen and what would be needed. The circled numbers are the man weeks anticipated to complete each stage of the work. At this time, I was back and forth from Amblin in LA and ILM in San Francisco about 2 to 3 times a month, and there were a lot of quick briefcase shuttle copies made for in-flight reviews. That's what these are. Estimates broken down into sculpts, molds, fabrication, finish, materials, etc. When you're sitting down with a script to figure out the time and the cost, it requires you to imagine each piece that needs to be made, and how much space it will take up, and how many people will perform the work for how many weeks. Do this for each piece, and visualize the accumulation of all the pieces and all the work, and then assign the numbers to the tasks, space, and materials. While I was in the Amblin story department, there was a very spirited discussion going on in another design room about how tall the fully animatronic T-Rex could be on set with first unit. The team was telling Steven the dinosaur could not exceed 16 feet high, and Steven wanted more. Steven asked me to mock up a quickie T-Rex head based on a 24-foot scale, and we put together a big foam fabricated head. We all got together on a Saturday and attached the head to a crane and hoisted it to 24 feet next to a large 24-foot scale graphic of a T-Rex outline attached to the side of one of the stages. Steven took pictures and then he got into an SUV and positioned the head around the vehicle while he took more pictures. He sat in the truck reviewing his shots and got out and said, "It's going to be 24 feet. See you all Monday." Then got into his limo and left. I didn't see the technical design team again. This is an original Amblin print of the magazine paste up back when such things were still done. Picture of that Saturday on the Universal backlot where this all happened. Kathleen Kennedy is on the left in a long-sleeved black coat. Ed Vero is leaning on the T-Rex head in front of everybody. I'm in the gray shirt with the girl's face on it, Les Miserables, standing near Steven Spielberg. Rick Carter and Bob Gurr are on the right of Steven, both in a short-sleeved blue shirt. Bob has the silver hair. I worked with Bob back in 1983 when I first moved out, and then again at the end of the 80s on Jurassic Park. Also pictured are Jim Teagarden between me and Steven, Tom Cranham behind us on the ladder, David Lowery behind Rick, and Marty Klein beside Bob. Inset is me in my apartment's courtyard with a copy of a T-Rex skull fossil from the American Museum of Natural History. One of Amblin's requests was to have a model in miniature of a T-Rex skull, so I borrowed from a friend a fiberglass full-size casting of the T-Rex fossil skull from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. I assigned the sculpt to Dan Platt, and this is a raw, untrimmed cast from the original mold made at the time of this early stage of production. These drawings are Amblin studio copies of plans by animatronic engineer Bob Gurr, Disney's animatronic supervisor for decades, going back to the original Lincoln for the 1963 World's Fair. Note his signature, R.H. Gurr, and company name Gurr Design at bottom of copies. These designs were, on paper, look at 24-foot tall approach. Note rough quality of drafting. The fragments of mechanical drawings show the approach as pneumatic and hydraulic and attached to a track. This was done quickly to show Steven an animatronic T-Rex to 24-foot scale. These copies were some of the material I was given to scale the foam mock-up. Not long after all of this, Universal pulled the plug, because they had spent $2 million and didn't have a script. Well, they had over 220 pages in a binder, but that's not a script. That's basically the novel without its cover, and was not what Universal wanted developed. About a year later, production started up again, and now Stan Winston was involved, and history was being made. I miss Stan. Anyway, that was my glimpse at the early stage of the production process for Jurassic Park.
We weave through the fabric of existence as best as we can, creating memories of joy, triumph, and love, but challenged by despair, pain, and loss. No matter how we live, our threads come to an end. Only our stories are left behind. They are told by remnants of ourselves or through others. But it's one way we always remain.
Well, that's the program. Thanks for looking.